If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by HappyTummy.ie, the exclusive distributor of BioGaia probiotics in Ireland. Discover BioGaia Gastrus, a clinically proven probiotic for a balanced gut and improved well-being. BioGaia's probiotics, featuring Lactobacillus reuteri, are renowned for their trustworthiness and effectiveness. With origins dating back to the dawn of humanity, these probiotics are scientifically proven to support your entire gastrointestinal tract. And here's some great news for our Baby Tribe listeners. Enjoy a 10% discount on all BioGaia products at happytummy.ie by using the code BABYTRIBE10 at checkout. Invest in your gut health today with happytummy.ie and BioGaia.
Welcome everyone, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. Afif, how are you doing today?
Well done, Katie. It makes a change for you starting the podcast. I'm always welcoming people, so it makes a nice change that you have done it today. So thank you.
You're welcome. So today we're talking a little bit about baby foods and what's in them, and we're going to break it down. But just considering we're talking a little bit about sugar and all that kind of stuff today, how many Easter eggs did your kids get this year?
My multi-faith, multicultural kids that avail of all the religious holidays, regardless of their origin, I've lost count.
I've lost count
because they get Easter eggs from their mum, their aunties, their uncles, their granny.
We've noticed a huge increase in Easter eggs. They're now given out at birthday parties as the gifts, you know, the gift bags at the end. Sports, every sport they do, they nearly get a...
And you've got half a football team at home, so God knows how many Easter eggs.
Well, we put a ban on it the last 2 years. Yeah, we did, because we were just getting so many of them. So we, much to the upset of the kids, I told my mother, I told my sister and any family members, we don't want them. So we said, but we made on the other side, the agreement with the kids, they could pick any Easter egg they wanted within reason. And that would be their soul. So they get a big one. Otherwise, if they want to get the little ones, then they're going to get a smaller Easter egg.
I saw a great one that was in the shape of a rugby ball of dark chocolate. I'd love one of those.
Full on dark chocolate. It'd be full heavy. You'd only eat little bits, but that's probably healthier.
Yeah. Is dark chocolate healthier than real chocolate?
There's less. It is in fat content, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Because the higher
the strength, the better it is for you. Plus cocoa. Isn't that cocoa?
Yeah, I prefer dark chocolate.
It has also cardiovascular benefits.
Does it?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, if you're eating chocolate in the grand scheme of things,
yeah,
it is healthier than if you're eating full on dairy.
You see, I've just finished a month of fasting and during Ramadan, and I usually give myself a free pass on sweets in the evening because I fasted like for, you know,
absolutely,
between 12 and 15 hours. I think I end up putting on weight during Ramadan because I pile 2000 calories.
Now, hold on. What kind of sweet things would you have in the evening? I'm intrigued now.
I would have...
probably a square of chocolate, guys.
No, I actually would have, you know, an ice cream. I would have some of the Arabic baklava things that I buy for Ramadan to just feel, you know, Ramadan-y. And I would also then have a chocolate bar. Like, it's ridiculous. No, it is. And I would do that almost every day.
And tell us this now, the Ramadan chocolates, is there a place you buy them in Ireland?
Yeah, you can buy them here now. There's a lot of places that sell them and they're lovely and they're made, they're homemade.
I thought your mom might send them over or something.
No. My dad did actually last year sent me, but it costs so much.
Yeah.
And then I had to pay import tax on them and I was like, Dad, I'm not doing this anymore.
Don't waste your time. I'll just take the local.
Yeah, I'll just take the local things. Like it costs about €300 to get them across. Oh yeah, it was ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous, because he had to pay an export fee because it was going from Kuwait to the EU. And then when they landed here, you get this email from DHL saying you have to pay €50. I was like, do I really want to pay €50 to get these?
Yes.
And then you feel bad because my dad went through the trouble of baking them himself.
So it's not sustainable at all.
It's not sustainable.
It's cheaper and better for the environment if you just get them locally sourced.
Absolutely. Yes, yes.
So it is something that we talk about. And we're like, I know the HSE had a big campaign about, you know, Easter eggs and how many we get.
A lot of people give out about that.
They were I agree with it fully. I was absolutely.
I heard people on Twitter giving at Sting saying, oh, will you just leave the kids alone? Let them enjoy Easter. But I mean.
But the problem is when I was a kid, we got one Easter egg. You could pick whatever you wanted, but you got one Easter egg. We didn't know. None of my aunts and uncles would have partaken in, would have given us Easter eggs. Now, I looked at friends and they'd be like, they've got four or five, one from granny and one from granny. It's like I was envious of them. But you know what? It's a real. You know, it's too much at times and everything in moderation. My sister is great, but like last year she found an Easter egg still on her press and it was sitting up there for a year. It had gone off. And I was like, you didn't eat it. And she's like, I forgot all about it. I was like, that's ridiculous.
Wow.
That wouldn't happen in our house.
No. And you know, my kids have, like my daughter specifically, she will just find chocolate no matter where you keep it or hide it, you know.
And if she'll sniff it out.
Oh, she will sniff it out. And she's such a sweet tooth and she'll just go and pick at it and pick at it and pick at it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that, Lily would definitely. Luke could smell. He would hear upstairs. He wouldn't hear you if you're calling him for dinner. Would you open a wrapper?
Yeah.
And it's like he comes out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
He's down that stairs going, what have you got?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Anyway, today we're going to talk all about it. So Afif, start us off.
Today we're going to talk about sugar intake in infants and children, but we're focusing predominantly on infants. And the reason we bring this up is because, you know yourself, Katie, the growth pattern of children over the last couple of decades have changed significantly.
Yep.
And the amount of processed foods that are available to us really, really cheaply has also changed significantly. And as a result, I think we need to inform parents and maybe empower them a little bit with information so that they know how much sugar their child should be taking and where the sugar is present. Because you know what the interesting thing is? That even foods or drinks that are labeled as no added sugar or labeled as containing natural sugars, they actually may contain a lot of free sugar, especially when you're looking at things like fruit juice or pureed fruits that you buy in the shop for your baby. Because under European regulation, there's actually no mandatory labeling of free sugar. So if you look at the nutritional information on all the packets, you will see fats, you will see proteins, and then you will see carbohydrates. And then underneath it, you will see of which sugars. But it doesn't tell you how many of those of which sugars in quotation marks are actually free sugars. But you can make an assumption that most of the of which sugars are actually free sugars. And it's the free sugars that we worry about. And let's try and break it down. Free sugar is defined by the World Health Organization as all monosaccharides and disaccharides which have been added to foods and beverages by the manufacturer, plus sugar naturally occurring in the food items themselves. So what do I mean by monosaccharides and disaccharides? Monosaccharides are the kind of simplest forms of sugars. So they are your glucose, fructose, and galactose. Our bodies feed on glucose. And then you have disaccharides, which are slightly more complex sugars. So they're two simple sugars attached together. So we have lactose, which is the predominant sugar or carbohydrate present in breast milk, also present in formula, also present in cow milk. That's actually made of glucose and galactose. And then you have sucrose, which is the other disaccharide, and that's made up of fructose and glucose. And that's the sugar that is usually present in fruits and things like that, but also that's the free table sugar that you see. So which do you think is actually sweeter, glucose or fructose?
I would say the fructose.
Yeah, fructose is actually the sweetest sugar, and that's the one that is present in all sweet and nice things. And that really is the one that we should try and reduce our intake of, because most of the sugary drinks, juices, fizzy drinks contain huge amounts of fructose. And it's not actually a good idea to consume those huge amounts of fructose. And I'm going to try and break down and tell you why. So first of all, do you know, and I didn't know this until recently, so don't feel bad if you don't know, do you know how many grams of sugar should a two-year-old consume in a 24-hour period?
Less than 5 grams.
No, it's actually 15.
Is it?
Yeah, 15 grams. 15 to 16 grams of sugar. And that's daily free sugar intake, which is actually not a lot. But
maybe I was thinking if you're looking at the back of a packet, it should be less than 5 grams, is it not?
It should be less than 5 grams per 100 mils. Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. But in a 24-hour period, a 2-year-old should be consuming 15 to 16 grams of sugar. There aren't definite data for what a 1-year-old should consume, but it should be less than that amount. Because I didn't realize this, what I suppose I kind of did as well. We have, from birth, an innate tendency to like sugary foods and salty foods as well. So even babies from birth actually like sweet things and like sugary things. And if you give them a sugary or sweet thing, they'll go mad and they'll suck on it. We know that there's data suggesting that children that predominantly formula feed over the first 6 months are more likely to develop a sweet tooth down the line compared to breastfeeding infants predominantly. The reason for that is breast milk, although is sweet, actually changes its flavor constantly depending on the mother's diet. Whereas the formula, the taste is really, really, but it's also mainly, it's very, very constant. So as a result, children are typically phobic to new foods and new flavors. And accepting new tastes are more likely to happen in a breastfed infant because they're already exposed to varying flavors over the first year of age when they're feeding off their mom, because their mom is actually exposing babies to different flavors through her diet. What parents need to be aware of is that not that giving formula is a bad thing. And you know, on this podcast, we never give information like this to worry or scaremonger. We give information like this to inform parents. It becomes really important then to expose your child to varying tastes when you're weaning them, and not start, and we've spoke about this before, with just the sweet tasting fruit, that we have to expose them to all the different forms of taste, you know, the sour and the less sweet vegetables from early on, because they will start rejecting them. But being consistent and offering them various flavors is important from early on, especially if you're formula fed.
For all parents across board, start with savory and we work our sweet in, because they'll always take sweet. And even with the savory, when it comes to it, it takes about 12 to 15 tastes for anyone to like something. So just do it one day. Consistency is key. Same thing, few days in a row. Don't discard a whole batch because of it. But yeah, you'll often see it. You see a child when they're starting to wean, you bring the pureed fruit in, they will literally suck it off the spoon.
Yeah.
They love it.
In terms of a top tip for taste development, so preference for sweet taste is innate, but you can actually change it or reinforce it by your exposure and what you expose your child in. So you can actually change that preference by exposing them to a varied diet. And that becomes really important for allergies as well, as we discussed last season. So going back to the sugar requirements of babies, you know, a two-year-old, for example, should consume about 15 grams of sugar in a 24-hour period, roughly no more. And a one-year-old should consume a lot less than that. Now, if you actually look at the commercially available baby foods that are promoted as being healthy, such as the fruit purees that you could see, that are actually, by the way, says that they're suitable from about 4 months plus. And I would never advocate giving a 4 month old, you know, a jar of puree. It's preferable to wait until at least 5 months of age before you introduce solids. And also these kind of squeezy yogurts that are mixed in with strawberry and banana, with a big label saying no added sugar.
Well, I suppose the thing is that they're not lying. And this is what parents get really confused about.
Yeah.
But when you puree any fruit, it actually then increases the
amount of free sugar available.
So that's why we kind of talk about smoothies and puree, or, you know, when we talk about smoothie drinks and parents think they're really good, but you would never put that much fruit and puree it and eat it in a whole, or get an apple, an orange, a pear and eat all that in one go. But you puree it and put it into a smoothie form, you can consume way more than you would naturally take.
Yes, so, and that's a very good point you bring. So for example, in those pureed foods, a pack that a child could consume very, very quickly will actually contain about 12 grams of free sugar.
Yeah, it's huge.
So that's your whole daily intake for a two-year-old consumed within a space of 5-6 minutes. And it's that big sugar load that we get concerned about. And there's a difference between free sugar and sugar that is mixed in with the fruit in terms of fiber. That is okay to eat, and that is actually good for you. Our body actually has no need for free available sugars.
Yep.
So we could survive on sugars available in whole fruits. And what you said is actually pretty impressive, because if you compare an orange with orange juice, same calories, same energy, and same water content, right? You will consume the orange in about maybe, I don't know, 5-10 minutes. And that gives you then the sugar load of 20 grams, right? But the same amount of orange in a juice, you will consume that sugar in free form rather than in fiber form, and you will consume it in about 10 seconds. You could gulp it down in 10 seconds. So it makes a huge difference in how you consume things. And that's what people mean when they say not all calories are the same.
Yeah.
You know, so consuming those calories in terms of fruit and fiber is much better for you than consuming it in juice form. And the same applies to children. Because what do we actually worry about? This is a warning. I will talk about the microbiome a little bit.
Every season, or every season, I should say every episode.
Every episode.
Every episode, he manages to bring it in some shape or form.
We should call this the baby microbiome instead of the baby tribe, or the microbiome tribe, actually. Yeah. Yeah, that'll be a good
He'll be launching his own his own probiotics soon.
Yeah.
Afif's baby tribe.
Afif's microbiome. Yeah, exactly. Well, if you listen to Keeping Up with the Kardashians, I got accused by my wife of actually inventing the microbiome.
Yes, I did hear that.
Yeah, she gives that to me. So yeah, please go and have a listen to the bonus material and please subscribe. So Katie, let's pause for a moment to remind our listeners that Baby Tribe is now part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, and we are now in a position to offer our listeners bonus content via Head Stuff Plus.
That's right, Afif. Our spin-off series, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, hosted by you and your lovely wife, Anne Doherty, treats our listeners to the fabulous husband and wife discussions and expansion of points raised here on the Baby Tribe, and some science as well.
So please subscribe for as little as €5 per month and make sure to select Baby Tribe and Keeping Up with the Kardashians as your podcast to support. Subscribing will give you access to all the bonus content on Head Stuff Plus. And guys, Katie's weekly appearance fees are getting a bit much for me, so we'd really value your support.
I wish everyone. Afif's skincare routine is ridiculous. You should see the potions and lotions he uses every single day.
Listen, it takes a lot to look this good. Thank you to everyone who have subscribed so far. And if you haven't subscribed yet, why the hell not? Anyway, moving on. The other big issue is that the satiety. So you won't feel full if you consume sugar in a very quick amount like that. Whereas if you consumed it in the form of fruit, same amount of calories, you're actually will feel full as well. And if you consume a lot of sugary drinks, or if your child consumes a lot of sugary drinks, then you will have nutritional displacement, meaning that these foods that are high in sugar will displace more nutritious foods in your diet. So fructose in big amounts is not a good idea. And again, everything in moderation. Should you eliminate these things? Absolutely not. But you should be mindful of how much your child is taking. And the smaller the child is, the bigger the proportion of the sugars are in the chocolate bar or in the fizzy drink that you're giving them. So being mindful of these things is important.
And I think one thing just about the drinks is that you see it on the market shelves. If you probably don't go into the shelves there, Afif, and do the shopping. But if you look at the baby aisle, it is product after product after product. Lovely bright colours. You know, it's really targeting parents. But the juices, they're on the shelves all the time. There is no necessity ever for a juice.
Yes.
Really in the very young age group. Now, if they're getting older and they're at a party, that's what we would have always said. Fair enough, diluted down. But realistically, under ones, under twos, there is no necessity. And fizzy drinks, honestly, shouldn't definitely be consumed. Now, each to their own, and every family makes their own decision. But really, you're only igniting the love for that product when it's not a necessity at that point.
And remember, you can precondition your child to love sweet things. And the things I really hate are the sweeteners that you put in water to get your kids to drink water. You know, I see a lot of parents telling me, oh, he won't drink water, so I'm putting a sweetener in it for him to drink it. And I said, that's the worst thing you can do, because they need to learn to drink.
But as I always say, when you start the weaning process, start with water. We shouldn't be putting our food preferences on our kids. Yes. And if you start with the same thing, they will actually start taking it. But babies don't suddenly start drinking cupfuls of water. And I think parents have just a very wrong perception that they, when we get the sippy cup, they should be nearly gulping it down. They don't. They take sips. The more they get exposed to it, the better they get. And after one, then you will find a kid that will drink it.
And I get asked this all the time, especially during the weaning phase, between 6 months to a year, my baby won't drink a lot of water. That's and you have to say, they're getting hydrated from the milk that they're still probably taking and the food that you're giving them. So they don't need to actually consume huge volumes of water and sweeten it or mixing it with things.
It's the skill that we're trying to get them to practice.
Yes.
It's the skill of the sippy cup or the open cup is actually what you're trying to teach your child, not the volume that they're going to consume.
So why should we avoid a high fructose content? Well, it's been associated with a lot of issues, including liver health. So high fructose consumption is associated with an increased risk of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, because fructose in our gut is metabolized or is converted into fats. and those fats are actually end up being stored in our liver and other parts of our body. So it can promote excessive weight gain as well, and it increases the risk of having cardiovascular issues down the line and also high blood pressure. And it preconditions you for insulin resistance. So it increases your risk of picking up type 2 diabetes.
I like that, picking up type 2.
Did I say picking up type 2?
Yeah, I'm picking up type 2 diabetes.
You're picking it off the shelf, right beside the brightly colored sugars and juices. And as a recommendation, just read the labels carefully and look for baby foods, not that just have a label of no added sugar, because a lot of the pureed foods will not have added sugars, but there's a high amount of free sugars. Yeah. So we're looking at generally in and around, you know, the 5 to 6 grams per 100 mils would be a good gauge. If you see a food item that has about 10 or 12 grams of sugar per 100 mils, that's 12.5% of the volume of that food item is sugar. That's what that is saying. And you should, by and large, either avoid it or limit its use when you're stuck. We're never going to tell parents not to use these, but just be mindful of not using them too much, and making food at home is the better option.
Like, look, we all need convenience at times. I'm a mom of four. I've been where you've been, where I'm trying to run to a hurling match and still make it back for the third or the fourth. So like, everything in moderation, that's the biggest thing. And it's more that if you're giving them on a daily basis and you're giving them very frequently, the problem is that when you start introducing your own dinners, the taste is very different. Yeah. So like, by all means, the biggest thing with the weaning process is getting onto your own dinners as quick as possible. And I think there's so many cookbooks, and I do so many one-to-one consults with parents, and they're all using these, like, you know, really extravagant recipes. I'm like, are you going to be cooking this as a family menu, like with your family as time goes on? They're like, no. And I'm like, well, cook the dinners that you make now. Just eliminate your salts, your preservatives, your pepper, all those kind of things, and make the same dinner as your baby's progressing. These are great as a you know, here, hit and miss, kind of, you're running late, you've got it, then absolutely. And like you said, just check the back, and just under 5 to 6 grams, fair enough. But over that, then there's other alternatives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to end our chat before we bring on our guest by talking about how fructose affects the microbiome, because I think that's...
I wasn't getting away from it, guys.
No.
I wasn't getting away.
But this is... I bet you I'm going to impress you by this knowledge.
Ooh.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I was impressed when I first read it. So excessive fructose. So our bodies aren't actually designed to process high amounts of free fructose. Our guts actually like fructose that is mixed in with fiber, and that actually feeds our gut bacteria and maintains a healthy gut microbiome. But a high amount of free fructose can lead to what we call is dysbiosis, which is the imbalance in the gut microbial community, which means an overgrowth of potentially harmful bacteria and a decrease in beneficial bacteria. So what this does is a couple of things, actually. There's an increased production of endotoxins. So endotoxins are little molecules produced by the bad bacteria that can actually trigger an immune response and can lead to low-grade chronic inflammation in our bodies as well. The other thing that fructose does is that it actually increases gut permeability, and that's something that is not a good thing. So we all have a lovely mucus layer that is coating our cells in our gut that acts as a barrier against toxins that we may ingest that are present in food or whatnot. And that keeps us safe from those toxins. High amount of fructose actually breaks down that barrier, breaks down the amount of mucus, and also breaks down the tight junction between the cells underneath it. So it actually impacts two protective barriers that we have in our gut. And what happens then, the toxins will seep into our system rather than staying in the gut and being pooped out. And that leads to chronic inflammation. So chronic inflammation is our body's way of attacking those toxins. But if there's a constant state of inflammation, that's when you become more susceptible to developing conditions down the line. Heart disease, joint disease, liver disease, diabetes. All of these things are actually triggered by chronic inflammation. And fructose is a big culprit. Are you impressed yet?
I am.
There you go. The last one, which is actually quite relevant, is, did you know that your gut microbiome plays an important part in regulating your satiety?
I just happened to see that as I was scrolling slightly further down on your conversation.
So you didn't read your homework last night that I sent you?
I did bits of it, but not all of it, Afif.
Yeah, this is what I have to deal with, guys, on a daily basis. She comes in without not having read the homework and just literally reading it as we do the episode.
Notice my surprise as I'm going, yeah. It is interesting after all, Afif.
There you go. So I actually didn't know this. So the gut microbiome plays a role in regulating the hormones that affect our appetite, such as leptin. You hear about people taking Ozempic or what is that? Ozempic, yeah. To try and regulate their appetite. Well, guess what? If you actually regulate your diet, your microbiome will do that for you. And if the healthier the microbiome you have, the less hungry you're going to feel down the line. Because if you disrupt the microbiome due to high fructose intake, then you disrupt these hormonal signals, potentially leading to increased food intake and weight gain.
No.
Mind blown. There you go.
I was gonna say the microphone drop.
Will we do a mic drop sound? I'll add that sound effect later. We don't do sound effects on the baby
child. No,
but
we can do it today.
Well, now that I'm doing the podcast course, I know how to
Seriously, guys, this is what I have to deal with on a regular basis. So go on, tell us, what are the recommendations then for a healthy microbiome?
So moderate your fructose consumption. Limiting high fructose foods, especially those containing added fructose, can help maintain a healthy gut microbiome. And that applies for kids and adults, by the way.
Yep.
And diversify your diet. People keep asking, what's the best way of maintaining a healthy microbiome? And we know that probiotics do play a role. However, biggest impact in keeping your microbiome healthy is to actually diversify your diet. What does diversify mean? It means eating a whole load of different foods. And I love Orla Walsh, the dietitian's way of saying it. You must have as many colors on your plate as possible throughout the week. Aim for different colors, and that actually gives you the diversity.
And I think the problem is we just get stuck into doing our normal dinners that we, every day, every week.
Yeah.
You know,
so challenge yourself and having different colors on your plate.
It's the psychological impact when you put a dinner on the table and then everyone goes, oh, I'm not eating that. I don't like that.
And listen, I need to actually practice what I preach, because my kids sometimes have the chocolatey Weetabix for breakfast. They're picky eaters. We have to battle with them. So I hear everybody now probably groaning saying, you know, how can we achieve this? It is not easy.
No.
I acknowledge.
I suppose, look, it's just about offering. We can't force them to eat it, but the more they see us eat it, the more likelihood they're going to do it. And I know the next one you're going to be talking about is the probiotics and prebiotics. But like when we talk about all those yogurts, and it's something that I would have always done with my kids, would be I would never give in a very small infant. My yogurts that I started with was pure natural yogurt.
Yeah.
And they like all my kids would love natural yogurt. And there is times that I put like a spoon of fruit puree into it, but it would be very minimal. But they love it. And they've grown to eat those yogurts way quicker. So as they progress, they use like their raspberries with their natural yogurt in whole form.
And there are specific probiotics that are designed for newborns that you can give if you want to give them. And they're available in the market as well. So, you could always go down that route if you want. There is some evidence suggesting that it can help with things like fussiness and crying, and respiratory infections and constipation.
I've got the whole family on probiotics at the moment.
I'm taking them as well myself. So I think it's definitely worth going for.
Thank you for that, Afif. We are all mind blown.
Absolutely.
So Afif, who is joining us today?
Today, I am delighted to welcome Dr. Kieran MacDonald, who is a consultant pediatric endocrinologist in Children's Health Ireland. We spoke about many different topics, including infant and childhood growth, puberty and diabetes. So let's have a listen. Kira, thank you so much for joining us on the Baby Tribe podcast. I'm delighted that you have agreed to come on. We were due to record this a bit earlier, but we got buried in the snow, didn't we?
We did too, Afif. It's nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So before we start talking about the topics that we are going to discuss, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what made you go into the field of pediatrics and endocrinology as well?
Well, that's taking us back a few centuries. Okay, so I think I always wanted to be a doctor. That was pretty clear from the start. And I always wanted to be a children's doctor. I can't remember a time where I didn't want to be. I was born and raised in RD in County Louth, went to Trinity for my undergraduate. And then after a couple of years of postgraduate training in pediatrics, I had an opportunity to go to Australia. And when I went to Australia, I had just done two different jobs, one adult under Professor Gerald Tompkin and one paediatric under Professor Hilary Hoy in diabetes and endocrinology. And it just made sense. So when I went to Australia, I deliberately requested the opportunity to start with an endocrine job. And there was four consultants there in the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. And I spent three lovely months with them. And at the end of that, they said, we'd like you to stay on and do a fellowship with us. And that was it. My pathway was determined. So I've been doing that now for just over 20 years.
Wow. So much experience gathered. And yeah. You're a parent as well.
Yes, that's right.
And having children, has that changed your outlook on pediatrics?
It's made me a lot more patient with other parents and a lot more understanding, I think. There's a lot of nuances to parenthood that can't be taught. It has to be experienced. And because of that, I think I'm probably a better doctor because I'm a parent.
Yeah. And that's been something that a few pediatricians have told me. And I empathize with that myself. I used to probably be a little bit impatient sometimes with parents. And now I get it.
Yeah.
You know, once you become a parent. And I think it's a lovely compliment to doing pediatrics. So let's launch straight into it. We're going to talk about diabetes. But first, I wanted to chat about how children grow over the last, I suppose, few decades has changed a lot. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the basic things I would do in endocrinology is I would see a lot of children whose parents are concerned that they might be too small or too thin. And a lot of what I do in my job is growth monitoring. And it's very interesting to look at it because sometimes you feel you're getting referred to children who are actually following a normal growth pattern and that maybe you should be seeing the other ones. It used to be that all children would be growth monitored with area medical officers, which has got harder because the workload has got much greater. And in other countries, you would often have community paediatricians tracking growth. So at the moment, what we would do in this country, we would have community doctors and GPs looking at growth charts, and they tend to refer to us the bottom 3% or the top 3% of the growth chart so we can assess how they're doing. And I always am concerned that you have to therefore be already abnormal before you're flagged.
And on the 3% that you're talking about, are we talking mainly weight or length or both?
It's a bit of both. So if I take you through the growth pattern of childhood, because I think it's important to just emphasize what happens. So your growth is led by nutrition from birth, well, from antenatally, as you well know, until about the first 3 to 4 years of life. And then from there, there is a transition phase where growth is taken over by growth hormone and your growth rate slows down. And at that stage, your appetite should also slow down. So it's not unusual for parents to report that as their kids are approaching primary school, that their diet has decreased and they're getting more picky because they're meant to. They don't need as much energy because they're not growing as fast. And they would often be the children that get referred because parents are concerned about their intake, whereas I expect that to be normal. And then children grow at a much slower rate through childhood. And it's not until puberty, which, again, people expect happens as a teenager, but happens from 8 years in girls and 9 years in boys. And at that stage, you should start to see an increase in intake and an increase in growth rate. That, of course, continues until you finish growing. And one of the things we're seeing at the moment is that because children are not seeing that piece or not noting or being told to finish their food at an age where they should be getting more picky, that children are steadily, slowly but steadily, eating a little bit more than they need. So slowly but steadily over childhood, gaining a bit more weight than they should. Often the nutrition drive that comes with that means that they're taller in childhood, that they go into puberty earlier, but then that they do finish growing earlier because your growth potential is dictated by your genetic features that you get from both parents. But as a result, if your weight gain is off, then what happens is that when you reach the end of your growing and it is earlier than other kids and then they're eating more around you because they're still growing, you continue to eat more, you continue to grow. And that's where they tip into overweight and obesity. But to me, the tracks of that come from early childhood. So I think we're seeing a lot more of that.
And in terms of the earlier puberty that you mentioned, is that mainly driven by nutrition or are there other factors?
Yeah, so I mean, puberty's incredibly intricate, you know. I mean, I always say to families when I meet them that when a child is born, they're primed to be in puberty because it's the same hormones that help you grow when you're in a teenager that help you grow as a baby. So they're switched on and it accelerates growing for the first 6 to 8 months of life and they switch off by coming out of sync. So puberty is in fact suppressed. And the three factors that kick it back into sync and allow puberty to continue, one is leptin, which is weight and appetite based. The second one is a neurogenic signal. And the third one then is kisspeptin, which is the puberty onset hormone. So when weight reaches a certain threshold, and I've seen this over the years, it is the kickstart to put the others into sync for puberty to start. And you'll often see that in kids who, for whatever reason, be it chronic inflammation or malabsorption or children who are restricting their eating, they'll always be the ones with the later puberty because they haven't reached the weight threshold yet.
And the weight threshold that you speak of is dependent on their height as well. So it's not the same for each child.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I would definitely have numbers in my head that if people contact me and say we have this kid and they're not in puberty yet, I'll always ask the weight. And if the weight is below a certain point, I'll go, I don't expect that child to be in puberty, but that's a low weight for age. So they should get checked out for that reason.
When should you get concerned about the lack of onset in puberty in boys and in girls?
So by definition, it's over 16. But if someone truly wasn't in puberty at that stage, it would take you 3 to 4 years to medically induce it. And that would take a child or a young adolescent into their 20s. So we always aim to look by 14. So if there's no signs or symptoms of puberty by 14 years of age, I do think it's worth checking out. I would also say that at least 50% of the boys and girls who come to me between 14 and 16 actually have subtle early signs of puberty and they're fine. So we wouldn't necessarily have to investigate or intervene in most of the boys and girls that we see.
I want to talk about diabetes because you hear that term a lot. Yes. And we know in adults, it's becoming a huge issue in Ireland and globally as well. I believe Ireland is quite high up in the rankings in terms of the percentage of adults with type 2 diabetes. Can you tell us the different types of diabetes that we see in children and how have the incidents changed over the years?
Diabetes in itself, diabetes mellitus, means from Latin, sweet urine. So that's how people knew it. Whereas diabetes insipidus, which is a brain-related condition, means watery urine. And that's how they used to be detected. So people always feel when they talk about diabetes that there's too much sugar and that comes from the diet. And that, for me, is the biggest misnomer for childhood. The majority, and I would say at least 90% of the children we see in the pediatric hospitals have type 1 diabetes. So type 1 diabetes means that your body has developed insulin deficiency. And that is a genetic tendency in the family that then switches on what we call an autoimmune message, meaning that the body turns on itself to get rid of something it actually needed or to cause inflammation. So for us, it's the insulin cells in the pancreas. So you have the genetic tendency, an antibody switches on, you get a message, an environmental message, which the belief is it's a particular family of viruses that makes the antibody message permanent and it starts to destroy insulin cells. And once you get below 50% of the insulin cells that your body needs to cope with your day-to-day sugar levels, you start to become symptomatic of diabetes.
And just in terms of the mechanism, to contrast that with type 2 diabetes, type 2 diabetes is more that you're actually resistant to insulin that's there rather than being deficient in the levels.
So in type 2, you need more insulin to maintain a normal sugar. So you're producing more and more of it. And that's usually driven by external factors because you're putting more sugar in or more carbohydrate based in. It doesn't have to be sugar. And your body is producing more insulin to match it. And it becomes a circle where you need more and more to achieve the same effect. And then you have these effects or side effects of having excess insulin in the body that results ultimately in the body not being able to produce enough insulin to stay on top of the sugars, and then that manifesting as very similar symptoms to type 1. But in type 1, because there's not enough insulin, and it's important to differentiate between the two, you will in both get increased thirst and increased urination. Possibly kids who normally were bed trained or toilet trained at night now start bedwetting. But in type 1, they are more likely to complain of tummy pains, to have funny smelling breath, and to lose weight. And it's really important that those kids get checked out. Whereas in type 2, the children are typically, not always, more overweight and will have the drinking and the urinating, but won't have weight loss. Trying to get the balance between the two and figuring it out, type 2 would not be as much of an emergency as type 1 can become.
The symptoms that you bring up are interesting, because it seems that the symptoms of type 1 diabetes may be a lot less specific. You know, tummy pain, a funny smell, losing weight. Sometimes they may be hard to actually pinpoint what that is, you know, as a parent.
And that's so true. And, you know, you would never fault a family for missing them, because they are vague, you know, especially in a hot summer. Kids will be thirsty. You know, if a kid has a habit of behaviorally drinking, they can often go to the loo quite frequently. So, but I think I would always say to people that if it crosses your mind that it could be, it's very easy to take a urine sample to your doctor and get them to dip it for sugar. Or to ask, and not all cases, but some GPs do have the facility to check blood sugar levels. But you should always get them to check it after the child has eaten and not when they're fasting. Because if they're in the early stages of diabetes, you may miss it if you only check fasting sugars.
Okay, interesting. And then in terms of, and you've alluded to this a little bit, the risk factors for developing type 1 diabetes, are there things that you can identify, or is it predominantly a genetic condition? I know you mentioned that we think some viruses may cause it as well.
Yeah. So, but often that has happened 6 months to 12 months before the child even presents with symptoms. And that makes it very difficult for us to identify who is at risk. There's some very interesting studies as to how and why it happens. Like, you can't even genetically screen people and say you are going to get diabetes. So there's a German study of a cohort of 3,000 children in one town in Germany that consented, in true German fashion, to have a set of bloods every year since the children were born. And they have shown that the antibodies in some of the children would turn on and then turn off and then turn on and then turn off. And if you were in that pattern of on off, you never got diabetes. Whereas if you turn on and stay on, then most of the children that have that persistent pattern went on at some stage to develop diabetes. And I believe they are between 20 and 30 years into the study now. The prevalence in a typical population would be probably 3 to 4%. You're a 6% chance if you have a parent, and a 10% chance if you have a sibling with type 1 diabetes. So you can see that genetic influence is there. But really importantly, you can't check somebody's antibodies at any point in their life and say you have diabetes, because you might just be transient in that regard. And that's been the challenge with type 1 diabetes, which is definitely on the increase. There's an increased propensity for it in the Northern Hemisphere, in Caucasians. And as a result, you know, there has been a huge push to try and develop a vaccine towards it. So where we are at now is immunotherapy. So that trying to identify if people present early with symptoms and are antibody positive and have higher sugars, that they will try to delay the progression of diabetes. That's where we're at now.
And that's for type 1 diabetes.
And that's for type 1.
It's very fascinating, the genetic expression that you mentioned, that, you know, you and I may have the same genes, but if mine are switched on and kept on, I will develop type 1 diabetes, whereas if yours are on and off, even though we may have the same genetic makeup. So there must be an environmental factor that might influence this. Yeah. This might be a bit of an unfair question, but it's an interest of mine. The microbiome, how important do you think that is? Because we've discussed in a previous episode in the bonus material on how the microbiome can sometimes determine which genes you express and which genes you don't in your body.
There would be a very similar line of thinking in the diabetes field. And definitely in the past 3 to 4 years, there's been an increase in diabetes literature about whether the gut microbiome is influencing the development or even the expression of the antibodies, you know, let alone the kickover factor. I think we're seeing it younger. I think we're seeing the severity being increased. So I wouldn't be surprised if changes in our diet and therefore changes in our gut microbiome have resulted or have contributed to that. But past that, I would struggle to say how much it has contributed. I don't know enough in detail about that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very certainly interesting field to keep exploring from a research point of view. And the diagnosis of diabetes, is it simple to actually make the call?
I think if somebody is symptomatic and their sugars are up, then, you know, it is type 1 diabetes until otherwise proven. We take a set of antibodies when a child presents. And if the antibodies are positive, then we explore the possibility of type 2 diabetes. But for the most part, we will assume the child is type 1, especially if their glucose levels are rising with food and they are developing what's called ketones because they're not able to get the insulin into the cell and energy into the cells. So they're breaking down fat.
And how often does the child remain, I suppose, undiscovered that their first presentation would be the condition diabetic ketoacidosis? First of all, maybe tell us a little bit about it and how often are you seeing it at the moment?
So diabetes ketoacidosis means that you have become so insulin deficient that your body cannot move the sugars from digested food into your cells. So the cells themselves are starving and they are breaking down fat within the cell to get sugar. And when you break down fat molecules, you get some sugar, but three times as much other molecules, which are called ketones. And if ketones rise in the body, they create an acidotic state and they cause tummy cramps and vomiting, and you can become very unwell. So that is the extreme level of high glucose levels and high ketone levels. It is more likely if you haven't been exposed to diabetes in a family that you are going to end up in that situation. And unfortunately, more likely if when you're entering that acute stage, you get like some form of typical childhood illness, like a flu or tonsillitis or something, because that increases the body's need for sugar, and in the absence of insulin, it accelerates it. So typically a lot of children who present would unfortunately present because they've been unwell intercurrently. So how much of the time do we see DKA? More than we would like. We would like to be picking people up earlier. It's much easier to break a long-term chronic diagnosis to people who are well rather than people who are sitting in ICU worried about their child. Yeah. So absolutely from that point of view, and probably about 50% of the new diagnoses are in DKA at the moment.
I did a rotation with Professor Colm Costigan as a senior house officer. I think it was back in 2004. I've seen just from not being involved in the actual specialty, but from being, you know, a distant observer, how you manage children has changed dramatically over the last 20 years. So can you give us a snapshot of, you know, the most recent advances of how you actually manage the condition?
The first thing I will say is we've got better at it. You know, without taking, I'm going to talk about the technology in a second, but when I first started, a couple of years before you, when we first started, it was quite normal to tell families that your sugars were okay if they were up to 15. And then it was suggested that actually 15 was too high. We should say that the normal range, if you had diabetes, was 4 to 12. And then there was the sentinel moment where someone stood up internationally and said, hold on, if a person without diabetes is expected to have sugars in a normal range of 4 to 8, why do we not have the same expectation of people with diabetes, and why are we not aiming for that? So by changing the goalposts, we made control better. And that to me is the single biggest improvement I have made in my practice. The management of diabetes is so much easier in terms of what we can give families, you know. So it used to be that you had to prick your finger and do blood tests 6 to 8 times a day, more often if they were younger.
And can you imagine as a child having to do that?
Absolutely.
I always felt for the kids that they had to go through this, you know.
And the fact that they actually, for the most part, tolerated it so well was even worse, because you were going, I hate asking you to do this, but this is what you have to do. So in the last probably 20 years, we have had the onset and complete improvement of what we call continuous glucose monitors. And they went from being things that we had to download to see the results to now being real time. So the majority of the children, every child in our clinics gets offered access to a continuous glucose monitor. They don't all choose to uptake it for different reasons, but for the most part, they do. So that means they're wearing a flat sensor, approximately the size of a euro coin, on their arm or on the lower back, but mostly on the arms. And that will detect and send your blood sugar level to a device every 5 minutes. And it then averages it out every 30 seconds, averages it over 5 minutes. And you have a constant read of what the what the glucose level in your subcutaneous fat is, which maps slightly behind what it actually is in your actual bloodstream.
Is it a painless device?
I've worn them, you know, so it's like anything. If you break the skin, it'll be a little bit of discomfort. But once it's on, if you within 30 minutes to an hour, you forget it's there. You know, so it is a huge game changer, because most of the ones now transmit to the smartphone. So parents can see on their phone what their child's sugar is while their child is playing with their friends, you know, or the child goes to school, the parent can follow them on the app. You know, it's just that reassurance level that they have and the comfort of knowing that they're okay.
So you can monitor remotely as well. And that's
Absolutely.
Amazing. And what about the insulin administration then? How has that changed?
So we went from having to draw up insulin and mix insulin to actually having insulin pens where you just dialed it up and flicked it, to having insulin pumps where you delivered it based on instructions that your team would give you, to now having real-time communication between the continuous glucose sensor and the pump. So what we have now is what we call hybrid closed loop. Closed loop is the gold standard. That means that the sensor and the pump would be fully automatically managing your blood glucose without any human intervention.
So just so I get it straight in my head and for parents that are listening, so that the sensor will monitor the glucose level.
Yeah.
And it will tell the pump straight away, give more insulin, give less insulin, stop giving insulin, and then you don't have to think about it.
Yeah. So that's our aspiration, and we're 3/4 of the way there. So what we have now is called hybrid closed loop, which means that is happening within regulated levels. So the pump is allowed to increase the background, decrease the background based on what the sensor is telling it, but it does not deliver large amounts of insulin in response to food unless somebody is telling it how much food has been given. So that the operator, which is either the parent or the child themselves, counts their carbs and tells the pump how much carbohydrate they're having. And then the pump, and they're all taught to do that, and there's apps to help them do that. And then the pump has what's called an insulin to carbohydrate ratio, and it delivers a set amount of insulin to balance with the food that's going in. So we're almost there. What's very interesting is that the less some of the children have to do, the harder they find to do it. So there's been a new psychology to every change we have in diabetes care. And that for us as the carers is the challenge, you know, supporting families so that no matter what they're doing, the kids can get the best out of the diabetes care without causing a burden on them in terms of having a chronic disease.
Oh, that's very interesting, because I would have imagined that, you know, having to draw up your own insulin, trying to figure out how much to give based on how much you're going to eat would have been a logistical nightmare for parents and the kids. And now it's much easier. But I see how if things are taken away from you in terms of control, if you end up having to do something, then that's challenging in itself because you're not used to doing it all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think you've summarized that really well, Afif. Yeah. I think the other thing, though, is that sometimes we have to be aware of what happens if there's constant information, you know. So when you check the sugar 6 times a day, you checked it, you carried out an action in response to it, and you moved on. Now there is sugar information all the time. And for some families, that's difficult to cope with. You know, you're watching it go up, you feel you should do something. Sometimes doing nothing is the answer. But that feeling that you have to try and keep it within set levels, and that expectation that they have, not just, you know, on themselves, but sometimes they get it from us and we have to balance their expectations too. But that there's a pressure associated with that, which some families do struggle with, you know. So it's about trying to get the balance between, it's good that you can look at it, but it's like SATS monitors in intensive care units. You cannot sit and stare at the number all the time. It'll drive you crazy.
And I wanted to actually maybe digress a little bit and get your opinion on a couple of things.
Yeah.
We've spoken about this in the last season about the baby oxygen monitors that you can buy now and stick on your baby. And then it'll alarm, says the heart rate is high, the heart rate is low. The saturation oxygen levels in your baby are high or low. Your baby's breathing X and Y. And all it creates is just unnecessary anxiety. And what we forget is the natural variation. Because we don't measure what normal people do most of the time, we know very well how, you know, these things behave in the disease states, but we often don't know how they behave in a normal state. Mm. And that often creates so much anxiety when it deviates from our perceived ranges that we have. That was a very roundabout way of me asking you the question I want to ask you is, I listen to a lot of health podcasts and I've seen this increasing trend of them pushing or having advertisements on using those glucose sensors if you are training or if you are, you know, watching your diet. Now, these are people that don't have diabetes mm-hmm. that are either training or, you know, want to achieve a dietary goal, that they're pitching monitoring your glucose as a good thing. Mm-hmm. What do you feel about that?
I'll give you a little anecdote. When I did my thesis in Australia, I did it on the first generation continuous glucose monitors. So they were blinded. You wore them for 3 days, then you downloaded them and you looked at it. And my consultant said, go crazy. Go to McDonald's, eat stuff with high sugar, go out, you know, have fun. And I was in my mid-20s at the time. So there was a night of partying and we downloaded the sensor. And there was an extrapolation up when I was out in the pub. And then there was a sudden drop afterwards. And when I was asleep that night, the sugar was quite low. And of course, I saw this and I went, oh, my God, you know, was I hypoglycemic? And I wasn't. It was just that it was outside the measurement levels of the sensor at the time. But my consultant looked at it and winked at me and said, well, you're going to get diabetes in the next 10 years. And I literally spent 10 years waiting to get diabetes. And that is my worry about people using them. We have a very natural system in the body to cope with sugar. So if your sugar level goes to 10, your glucose threshold in your kidneys drops so that you pee out the extra sugar. And anybody can drive up their sugar levels. So a stress response to illness is a really good one, where you increase your body's steroids and you have more sugar around so the body can cope with the stress. If the body feels there's too much, it wheezes it out. So it's not unusual for people to have intermittent glycosuria, which is glucose in your urine, just in response to an immediate thing.
So healthy people can have that.
Yeah. You know, without naming brands, there are particular fast food outlets with chocolate milkshakes that are very high. They give you a sugar burst, or a lot of the new energy drinks will do the same. The body doesn't need that amount of sugar so fast. It wheezes it out. You check a sugar at that point, you're going to see it go up. And the other thing I will say is it's an absolute nightmare to pick up an asymptomatic child with a slightly elevated sugar, because then the onus is, well, then do we have to start intervening? Do they need a little bit of low dose insulin? They're not symptomatic. They don't feel any different when you start injecting them. Yet now suddenly they have all this paraphernalia and all these injections, you know, for being caught almost too early. So I think it's important from my perspective that I would prefer to see people present with symptoms, and then the acceptance of a chronic illness is much easier. And to use them for things like training, I think, is an absolute no-go, because you would have to understand the normal variance.
And a lot of people don't understand the physiology, as you said, and the normal variance. Mm. So they may think that they may have an issue and they may misinterpret the results. Mm. And I think, I don't know how reliable and accurate the commercial versions of these devices are. Yeah. So that's another big issue. Finally, Kira, I wanted to ask you, the outlook of children that you catch early and that you manage, yeah, in terms of quality of life down the line of and life expectancy, how has that changed?
Oh, I think it's phenomenally better. I mean, I always remember that people would come in, especially with the advent of the internet, the first kind of 5-10 years after I started training. You know, people would get the diagnosis and they would go and look up this internet thing, and they would get pictures of people who had awful complications of diabetes, be it kidney problems or blindness or lower limb amputations. And we know, and we have those studies from the mid 90s, that the better your glucose control, the less likely you are to have these issues at an earlier age. So we know that if we can maintain your blood glucose levels as close to normal as possible, that we are pushing that down the road, especially if we do that in the childhood and teen years. There's definitely a security blanket around it about how long it would take you to get complications. But also that I will say that the majority of my clinic now, with very few exceptions, would have diabetes control very close to the normal range because of all the technology we have. And because of that, I think it would be much harder for them to have the same problems. And I'm hopeful that it has changed their life expectancy, because in the mid 80s to 90s, you were guaranteed that, you know, you had reduced your life expectancy by 10 years by getting a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. Whereas now we're hopeful that it's very similar to normal.
And finally, any final words for parents that are listening?
I would comment on one thing, and it kind of feeds into a comment you made, which is that I do think that there is a positive to social media and the increased information we have in terms of young people being more aware about the importance of healthy diet and exercise happening in the teenage years. And it's now almost cool to go to the gym with your friends and to do exercises. And I think that can be very positive. I am concerned that people feel the need to engage in sort of gym habits in their teen years, like taking protein supplements, taking creatinine and weightlift, you know, kind of weight bearing exercises. And that is one of the things that I feel very strongly about. And I talk to all the kids in the diabetes clinic about, and in my endocrine clinic about, you know, your bones are not fully formed and fused, and your bone density is not at its peak till your mid 20s. So it's really important that any weight resistance or weight training that they do is less than 50% of their body weight, you know, and protein and creatinine supplements are not required outside of the diet at any age in the developing body. So they would be my take home messages to people. And if a parent is concerned about a child who might be weeing more and drinking more, I think it's important just to discuss it with your GP, because they're a great resource for reassurance.
Kira, thank you so much for joining us on the Baby Tribe podcast.
You're welcome. Thanks for the invitation, Afi.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. We're delighted to have shared this time with you, offering guidance and support for your parenting journey.
I've been Afif and she's been Katie, and together we've been your guides in exploring the multifaceted world of parenting. Remember, every step you take in nurturing your child makes a world of difference.
Stay connected with us and don't miss our next episode, where we'll continue to delve into the valuable insights and practical tips for raising healthy and happy children. Thank you for being part of our tribe, and remember, you're doing an amazing job.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.